Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Stripping down science. The Naked Scientists.
Hello and welcome to The Naked Scientists. This week we have a very watery show for you. We'll be diving into the science of the oceans, and in particular the effects us humans are having on those oceans and the seas around us. And to accompany us on this fishy journey, you've got me, Helen, and Dr. Kat.
Hello.
And so when Chris told me that he'd be leaving me in charge this week, I couldn't resist but take the chance to dedicate a show to the subject closest to my heart. Yes, those wonderful seas. We'll be finding out more about what lives in the oceans and what effects we're having on them. In the studio, we have with us Dr. Annelise Hagen from the Living Oceans Foundation, who'll be telling us all about her high-tech work monitoring the health of tropical reefs, both from underwater and from the air. And hopefully we'll also be talking to Stan Harpel from the University of California in Irvine, if we can get him on the line, to find out more about the impacts that all the fertilisers we use to grow crops have on biodiversity, both on land and in the sea. And here's Kat with a rundown of what else we've got lined up for this week on The Naked Scientists.
And today, as usual, we'll be giving an update on some of the latest science news. We'll be finding out if orangutans really are the king of the swingers, and why your brain is more like a worm than you may have thought. We'll also be paying a visit to the kitchen science guys, who'll be showing us how a diesel engine works, and finding out why is it that a bicycle pump gets hot when you use it. But would you have thought that you could actually use it to set fire to something? And although he may not be with us in person, Chris is here in spirit. We'll be hearing from him to find out how chemistry is being put to an unexpected use in following migrating birds around the world.
The Naked Scientists podcast, powered by UK Fast, the UK's best hosting provider, on the web at ukfast.net.
Well, for some of us, feeling like we have the brain of a worm is a particularly common experience. But new research has shown that our brains may actually have evolved from those of worms, making the origins of the nervous system much older than we previously thought. Vertebrates like us, people with a backbone, are very similar to insects and worms in a funny way, in that we evolved from the same ancestor. But our nervous systems are different, and we're thought to have developed after we split from worms. But new research from the European Molecular Biology Laboratory in Heidelberg now suggests that the last common ancestor of vertebrates, insects and worms already had a centralised nervous system similar to that found in us today. Now, the last common ancestor we shared with worms and insects was a little simple creature called Urbilataria. And since then, vertebrates have developed a nervous system with a brain and a spinal cord that runs down our backs, while worms and insects have this sort of rope ladder-like arrangement running down their belly. So how did these systems spring from one ancestor, this Urbilataria, and what did Urbilataria's nervous system look like? Well, to answer this, the researchers have been studying a really simple kind of sea worm called Platinarius dumerilii, or something like that.
I can't. You don't know your marine biology, do you?
What is it?
Actually, I don't know.
She doesn't know either. Platinarius can be thought of as a kind of living fossil because it still lives in the same sort of environment as the last common ancestors we had, so that's Urbilataria. And the worm also has a very prototype invertebrate nervous system, which is thought to be similar to that in our common ancestor. And so the researchers study the genes as they develop in these embryos as they're laying down the nervous system. And really surprisingly, they found that it was, you know, really similar to the process of laying down the nervous system in vertebrates, in, you know, organisms like humans. So in fact, the molecular landscape is virtually the same in these tiny invertebrate worms and us. So the researchers think that such a complex arrangement of genes and developing nerves couldn't have been invented twice in evolution. So it must have been the same system at work in this in our primitive ancestor. So the next challenge is to figure out why we have our nerves in our back and why worms have theirs in their bellies. But hopefully this should help to explain
That's fantastic. I think all those sea worms are very much overlooked and unloved, and we should care more about them because they can tell us more about ourselves. It's fantastic.
Love your worms.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to stay with a slightly genetic and animal-related story here, which is a new study out this week which has shown that for the first time, heat causes lizard eggs to change sex by switching off a key gene. Now, that might not seem especially revolutionary, but actually it means that biologists will now have to think completely differently about the way that sex is determined in animals. Now, before, we thought that basically there are two ways that sex can be determined, and they're very separate, and they can only one happens at a time. So for humans and other mammals, as well as birds and some amphibians, an individual animal is a male or a female, depending on the sex chromosomes it inherits from its parents. So for us humans, females have two X chromosomes, and a male has X, one X and one Y. For other animals, sex is actually controlled without the help of sex chromosomes, but instead it's governed by temperature. So in some reptiles like crocodiles and turtles, the number of male and females that hatch out of a clutch of eggs depends on the temperature that the eggs were kept at while they were being incubated. But now researchers from the Institute of Applied Ecology at the University of Canberra in Australia have discovered that one of their native lizards, the central bearded dragon lizard, which sounds fantastic.
Does sound cool.
And looks pretty cool too, actually. They found that they not only have sex chromosomes, but they're also affected by temperature. So if you keep your eggs at a higher temperature, then the ones that should be developing into males, based on their chromosomes, are actually turning into females. Now, the researchers think that the temperature is effectively switching off the effect of the male gene, the presence of which makes an individual a male, a bit like the Y chromosome, the whole chromosome in humans causes maleness to evolve, to happen in the embryo of a developing human. And so it's by switching off this gene that we think the unborn lizards become female. Now, as well as rocking our understanding of how sex is determined, this latest piece of research might also have really important implications for the survival of these species in the face of climate change. Because if we have too many females being produced and not enough males for them to partner with, it can really spell serious problems for the survival of species. So an increasingly warm world could be an increasingly female world, at least as far as lizards go.
Oh, bad news for lizards. We have another tale of climate doom, but this time it's lemmings. There's a common belief that lemmings commit suicide by flinging themselves off cliffs.
You're telling me they don't?
En masse. No, apparently is not true. But like most of us, lemmings are quite keen to stay alive, but their existence, as well as those of lizards, could be threatened by climate change. Now, these little rodents, they live up in the Arctic, and the Wildlife Conservation Society thinks that they may actually be very sensitive to the impact of the changing climate up there. Now, change in the lemming population could actually have really big knock-on effects in the wider ecosystem, because they're a really important food source for a number of predators. So, you know, Arctic foxes, birds of prey, weasels and even grizzly bears, they love snacking on lemmings.
Sounds tasty.
And in fact, the population of these predators does change in response to rises or dips in lemming numbers, maybe as they all do throw themselves off the cliff or something. But the most important thing that lemmings love is snow. And they live really deep down in snow burrows. So you have to have enough snow. It has to be thick enough to insulate them at the bottom of their burrows. And if the weather's too warm or if there's not enough snow, then this snow layer isn't thick enough. And so poor lemmings are freezing. So this is hopefully going to, you know, this will affect their population because they'll be freezing to death. And also unusually warm weather in the Arctic means that you get freezing rain and cycles of freezing and thawing, which can coat plants with ice so the lemmings can't eat them. So they've got no food and they've got no burrows. So next month, the Wildlife Conservation Society is planning to launch a major study to look at lemmings, look at their population, look at the predators that prey on them, and see how these are changing as the climate changes in the Arctic. And it's part of a large Canadian project called the Arctic Wildlife Observatory's Linking Vulnerable Ecosystems, which has the absolutely fantastic acronym Arctic Wolves.
Do you know, I'm thinking they may have come up with their acronym and worked backwards, but forgive them for that. It sounds like a very important study and one of those things that just increases our awareness of the changes that happen with climate change. Now, we're sticking with some creatures, bigger furry ones this time. We do have a very animal-based show this week, so I hope that's all right with our listeners out there. But as a famous character in a great Disney cartoon once sang, it turns out that the orangutans really are king of the swingers because they know just the right way to swing their way through the forest without wasting too much energy. Now, that's according to a new study published this week by a team of scientists from Birmingham University here in the UK. Now, to get around a forest and move across the gaps between trees, orangutans can't just climb along to the end of a branch and grab onto another one because they're just too big and the thin ends of the branches just wouldn't hold their weight. So, and also dropping down to the ground, walking along to the next tree and climbing back up another tree or perhaps up a vine that they could swing on, rather lovely. That's also not a great option. because it also exposes the orangutans to predators on the ground, like tigers, if there are any of them happen to be around.
Or left.
Any left, yes. I was trying to make this more of an upbeat story, but it always comes back to it, doesn't it? Anyway, so instead what scientists watching the orangutans in the wild have discovered is that the great orange apes bridge the gaps between trees by choosing young, springy trees with bendy trunks, which rock backwards and forwards in any direction they want to, a technique known as tree sway. And if they swing far enough, they can then grab onto the next tree relatively effortlessly and continue their journey. Now, the researchers estimated that the orangutans use about half the energy using their tree sway method compared to jumping directly between trees, and only one-tenth of the energy they would need if they were to climb all the way down to the ground, walk across and climb up the next tree. So there you go. King of the swingers. I think that's such a lovely idea of a researcher sitting in a forest watching orangutans swinging about in the trees. It's lovely.
Oh, they can use all the energy they saved for singing and tap dance routine.
Excellent.
Because that's what orangutans do.
They do.
Anyway, you've been enjoying our news stories. Hopefully you've been enjoying our news stories. But if you're a budding science journalist aged 14 to 16, then here's your chance to hit the headlines. Because Cancer Research UK is running a science writing competition called SciNews, and the charity is looking for the best, most attention-grabbing news stories related to medicine or health. So the competition is going to be judged by our top researcher and our Naked Scientist guest a couple of months ago, Fran Balkwill, along with Tim Radford, who's former science editor at The Guardian, and John Tickle, the presenter of TV science show Brainiac. Now, if you can write the best science story, you could win our fantastic first prize, which is a year's subscription to the science magazine BBC Focus. You can get a day with the Cancer Research UK press team and a chance to record your winning story for the charity's podcast, which is actually presented by me, so you get to meet me as well. I mean, that's a great prize. Second and third prizes are going to be science goodie bags packed with books and all sorts of stuff, and all the winning entries are going to be published on the charity's website. So if you're aged 14 to 16, living in the UK, then you can enter this competition now and find out how online at www.scinews, that's S-C-I-N-E-W-S, .org.uk. But you better be quick because the competition's actually closing on the 30th of April, so get writing and you could be a news journalist too.
Oh, if I was a bit younger, I could also enter. We've been having I think last week on the show, we were talking about why does it feel nice to stretch our muscles? And we didn't really know why that was. So we threw it open to you guys. And we've had a few interesting emails coming in, sort of giving us some ideas. I think we're still definitely on the lookout for the right answer. But anyway, we have an email here from Conrad in Canada, in BC, who says the reason why he's not a professional medical training. He doesn't have any professional medical training, but he does have aching muscles to run after he's run through the beautiful parks and forests of British Columbia while he listens to the podcast of the Naked Scientist on his MP3 player. Fantastic. Thank you so much for your email, Conrad. And he thinks this whole thing is about relativism, which sounds nothing to do with science at all, but it is, apparently. So not in the Einstein sense, but in a relative way, that if you're hitting yourself on the head with a hammer, it feels good when you stop. Muscles get sore from micro tears and trauma induced by exertion. And I'm guessing that stretching, he says, when sore, probably has a temporary desensitising effect on the sore muscles that provides, for a few moments at least, a respite from the ache. Stretching or massaging probably is similar to when a nurse pinches you before administering an injection. The temporary stimulus, which overstimulates your nerve receptors in the muscles and temporarily numbs the area from registering further pain. That's his theory anyway. What do you reckon, Kat? Anything there? Do you reckon that's...
I think there's something in it, yeah. I mean, certainly your muscles are full of these kind of cables that pull against each other. So by stretching, you are sort of pulling them apart.
Yeah.
And maybe you're overstimulating them.
Could be. We've also got this one here from Evgeny in Japan, who's wondering again why it is so good to stretch muscles. We all know it. We do it. It's wonderful. And so he thinks, what's he saying? Relaxed muscles need soft and at the same time strenuous exertion. This operation requires for them to, in a normal daily use of our muscles, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I must can't read it all out. It's quite long. But all our body needs to carry out for these kind of recovery operations is always connected by neurons within the nervous system, which stimulate centres of pleasure. And using a simple policy of bribery, he says, the central nervous system can train us by giving us a sweet candy every morning or then after to make us jump through the hoop for our own profit in result, which we even didn't suspect before. I'm quite confused about that, actually, but I thought I'd read it out anyway and see if anyone else out there has any ideas at all about why it is that stretching your muscles feels so good.
The Naked Scientists, supported by the Wellcome Trust.
Now it's time to take a trip across the Atlantic for another instalment from the Science Update team. This week, Bob Hirshhorn and Chelsea Wald will be taking us far away from the oceans to tell us more about some of the latest research being conducted in the driest places on Earth.
This week for the Naked Scientists, we're going to talk about two deserts on opposite sides of the world. I'm going to tell you why scientists think the already dry American Southwest is drying out even more. But first, Chelsea has this report on a desert region in Africa that's been very much in the news.
The war-torn Darfur region in Sudan was once home to an ancient mega lake, and some of that water may still be there. Geologist Farouk Elbaz is director of the Boston University Center for Remote Sensing. He says satellite radar data show that thousands of years ago, Darfur was a savanna with a lake the size of the state of Massachusetts. His team is certain that deep wells could tap the remains of that lake.
And the reason we are absolutely convinced that this is the case is the fact that we do have a very similar structure just north of the area we're talking about in the Western Desert in Egypt, and it has plenty of water. There are now 500 wells drilled through it, and there is potentially something like 150,000 acres of arable land, and the water that's available there could supply all of these acres for agriculture over 100 years.
Since the brutal conflict in Darfur is in part over water, there's hope that this new source could help bring peace.
Thanks, Chelsea. By mid-century, the American Southwest and parts of northern Mexico may settle into a permanent drought, one that for dryness could rival the Dust Bowl in the Depression-era Great Plains or the Southwest's own severe drought of the 1950s, the worst of the century. This is from climatologist Richard Seeger of Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. He and his colleagues analyzed 19 different climate models used in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth assessment report. The data suggests that a drying trend has already begun in subtropical areas worldwide.
It begins right at the junction of the 20th century and the 21st century. So the models say that, yes, this should already be underway.
Seeger says that unlike past droughts, the current drying trend is caused by changes in air circulation due to global warming. A long-term drought would increase the strain on already overtaxed water sources like the Colorado River. That could force the region's rapidly growing population to reevaluate its priorities.
Throughout the Southwest, it's not people that are the main users of the water, but it's actually agriculture, even in desert states like Arizona. So there's going to be some sort of difficult decisions that are going to have to be made about how the diminishing water resources get allocated.
He also notes that although there's probably nothing we can do to stop the drying trend completely, restricting greenhouse gas emissions may potentially limit just how bad it gets.
Thanks, Bob. We'll be back next time with stories about the things that profoundly influence your buying decisions, like, of course, celebrities. Until then, I'm Chelsea Wald.
And I'm Bob Hirshhorn for AAAS, the Science Society. Back to you, Naked Scientists.
Thanks, guys. And we'll be hearing more from the Science Update team next week. But don't forget, you can check out more stories from the AAAS in the United States on their website, www.scienceupdate.com.
Laying the facts bare, the Naked Scientists.
You are listening to The Naked Scientist with Dr. Helen and Dr. Kat. And now it's time for our kitchen science this week. So Derek and Dave are with Abby and Holly from Castle Manor Business and Enterprise College in Haverhill. And we're going to hear about the amazingly named Dave's Fire Piston. Hi, guys.
Hello there. We've come this week to Castle Manor Business and Enterprise College in Haverhill, where we're going to do a fantastic experiment, which we wouldn't like you to try at home. You'll probably find it very hard to set up at home, but even if you wish to, please do not try it at home. Okay, then. So with me, of course, is Dave. So what is it we're going to be looking at today, Dave?
We're making fire without even any matches.
Making fire without using any matches, and none of that kind of crazy survival type stuff either. This is pretty crazy science way of making fire without matches. Okay, then. And also, we've got two helpers here who's come from the college to help us out. So could you guys tell me your names and what years you're in, please?
I'm Abby. I'm in year 9.
Okay, and yourself?
Holly, year 11.
Year 11. Okay, thank you very much for coming down. And could I just quickly ask you what you like about science? Is there any particular thing in science you like? What about you, Abby?
Chemistry.
Okay, thank you very much. And yourself, Holly?
I like biology because my teacher, she's funny.
All right, okay. Is the teacher here? Oh, I don't know. All right, she is. All right, she's enjoying that recommendation there. Okay, good stuff. All right, then. Well, we've basically got an experiment set up for you guys to observe and tell us what happens and see if you can predict what's going to happen as well. So, Dave, what are we going to do? What have you got there, firstly?
Well, first of all, I don't know if you've ever at home tried pumping up a bicycle pot tyre really, really hard. Whether you've noticed the bicycle pump getting hot when you've been doing it, I don't know if you noticed this, Derek.
I have, actually, because I do cycle around generally, you know, so I have noticed this. You guys, do you pump up your bike tyres at all, Holly?
Not really.
Oh, dear. OK. Well, we've put the wrong people here, Dave. All right. OK. Well, we can assure you that when you pump up your bike tyre with the pump, then the pump kind of gets warm, doesn't it? So what's going on there?
Well, if you look at the gas inside the bike pump in the air in it with a really big microscope, it will look like all these little lumps called molecules flying around it, and they're bouncing around all over the place quite fast. Now, I'm going to use a tennis ball and a tennis racket. So the tennis ball is going to be like one of these molecules. So, Abby, if you'd like to take that. And imagine this tennis racket is a bit like the piston in the bike pump coming down.
Okay, so we're imagining that the ball is one of the air molecules, right? Okay, that's cool. And then the racket is like the wall, or alternatively the piston kind of crushing the air, the molecules that are inside there.
So first of all, we're going to see what happens when the molecule bounces off the piston and the piston's not moving. So Abby, can you throw that straight at here?
Okay, so what happened there, Abby?
It bounced back.
Okay, bounced back, as you'd expect, I suppose. Just a ball coming back off a racket, okay.
Yeah, now we're going to try it with the racket or the piston moving towards it.
All right, Holly, what happened there?
It bounced further.
Okay, it went further. So this is as if Dave is actually playing tennis and he's actually swinging the racket and so the ball actually goes further.
So if you imagine this racket hitting the ball, it's come back with a lot more energy. So if you imagine it with a molecule, that molecule's going to have bounced off with a load more energy, so it's going to be hotter.
That's if the piston is actually crushing the air, moving kind of towards the air, kind of compressing that air in that space.
And similarly, if the piston was moving away, the ball would bounce off slower, so the air would get colder.
Okay, so that's as if you throw a ball at a racket and you're kind of bringing the racket back and cushioning the ball and almost trying to catch it on the racket surface. All right then, so what are we going to do with all that?
Well, so now we're going to do this slightly more extreme version of your bicycle pump. What I've got over here, I've got a big clear tube made out of polycarbonate. With a little bit of... Can you see what's at the bottom of that?
What can you see, Holly?
Just small fibres.
Okay, yeah. What is it actually, Dave?
It's a piece of cotton wool at the bottom.
And it really is a very small amount, you know. It's not like a bud of it or anything. It's a few little strands of cotton wool, basically.
I've got a thing bunging up the other end. And I've got a piston with a big handle on it. So it looks like one of those big track pumps.
Okay, so it is basically like a bike pump, but unlike a bike pump, it doesn't have a valve for the gas to come out of. So basically what we've got here is a chamber, which is created by this kind of transparent tube that Dave's built. You built this thing, did you?
Yeah, on my lathe at home.
Yeah, one of your many kind of contraptions that you've built. Fantastic. Okay, and then basically what happens is the piston slots into that cylindrical chamber and basically makes an airtight seal. So now we've got basically a chamber, kind of a cylindrical chamber full of air. We've got a little bit of cotton wool in there and a big plunger, basically. So it looks very threatening. What are you going to do with that?
Basically, I'm going to push down this plunger incredibly hard and we're going to see what happens.
OK, and before we do that, Holly and Abby, I wonder if you've got any ideas. We're basically going to really push that down and crush the air in there, which has got the cotton wool in there as well. Any ideas what might happen? Abby?
It might go up, like the cotton wool might fly up.
The cotton wool might fly up. OK, good idea. And Holly, what about you?
I think the air particles might move the cotton wool around.
OK, move it around. OK, yeah, good guesses. All right, nice one. All right, well, we want you to tell us what you see when Dave does plunge it down. OK, here we go. Tell us what you see, guys. All right, what did you see, Abby?
Fire.
Fire, indeed. Holly, any more detail on that?
It just sparked.
Okay, I mean, basically, we saw the cotton wool bud. Well, it's gone, basically, as if by magic. It's quite good, really. It's completely gone. What can you smell?
Smoke.
Yeah, basically. We have vaporised it. Is that right? Have we basically made this thing disappear utterly?
Well, basically, when we crushed that plunger down there, it heated up the air. In fact, it heated up so much that it was hot enough to cause the cotton wool to spontaneously ignite in the air. And it set fire to it, and it burnt it almost entirely, producing smoke.
And there's nothing there. It is literally like a magic trick. It's gone, and in its place is a little bit of smoke, basically. And also, we had the bung at the end just pop out slightly. So was that just because, I don't know, the pressure was so high or something?
Yeah, the pressure was so high, it fell over a bit while I was taking it out again.
Oh, I see. So there you go. Dave's technique needs a bit of work there. Okay, well, there we go. So we've managed to show what you can do with a very souped-up bike pump, basically, which, of course, we do not wish you to try at home, but this is something that Dave's built and made very, very safe. So finally then, just quickly, is there anything that in reality that people might use that this relates to?
In a diesel engine, this is how they get the ignition. This is how it causes the explosions. There's no spark plug. There's no match at the top of it to light the fuel and make it go bang. All it does is it compresses the air in the cylinder incredibly hard. It heats up enough to cause everything to spontaneously ignite, causing an explosion, which fires the piston back down again with much more energy driving the car along.
OK, well, thanks very much, Dave, for setting up that experiment. And that's all from us here anyway in Haverhill. So it's back to the studio and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
So there you go. That's how a diesel engine works and why your thumb gets hot if you hold it over the end of your bicycle pump. Thanks to Derek and Dave and also to Abby and Holly, who are helping them out there at the Castle Manor Business and Enterprise College in Haverhill in Suffolk. Now, Dave's going to be back next week with some more exciting kitchen science mayhem, and you can join in this time. So all you're going to need is three jam jars, one full of jam, one full of water, and one full of nothing, full of air. And if they're the same, I think that's the same type of jam. So maybe get buying jam, get eating jam, but make sure you leave one jar uneaten. So that's next week's Kitchen Science.
We have in the studio right now with us Annalise Hagen from the Living Oceans Foundation. Hi, Annalise. Thanks so much for coming along today.
Hi, Helen. Hi, Kat. Nice to be here.
Now, first off, I guess we'll just have... We've all surely seen pictures of colourful coral reefs in magazines and TV, but perhaps we could start off by just explaining what are coral reefs made of? What are they living? Are they dead? What are the animals that actually live on a reef?
Well, yes, as you say, Helen, most people will have seen, if they haven't seen coral reefs firsthand by snorkelling or scuba diving, they'll have seen them on television and in newspapers. Coral reefs are a sort of hot topic at the moment. Coral reefs are actually comprised of tiny animals called coral polyps, which lay down a calcium carbonate limestone skeleton. And it's this skeleton that over hundreds of thousands of years forms a very large reef structure. And within those coral animals, they actually have a symbiotic relationship with a microscopic algae called zooxanthellae. And these enable the corals to lay down the calcium carbonate skeleton. And so they're a very important part of the coral reef ecosystem.
And we see these beautiful pictures, and some of us are lucky enough to visit them as well when we're diving and so on. And there's obviously like a heap of other animals as well that live on coral reefs. And I mean, they are one of the most diverse ecosystems in the world, aren't they? They're kind of on par with rainforests.
Yes, they're often described as the rainforest of the sea. They host numerous, numerous coral species, fish species, invertebrates, all sorts really. But not only are they very important for their biodiversity, hundreds of people around the world actually depend on coral reefs for financial gain through tourism, through fisheries, and the structures that they form are an important coastal protection barrier against wave impact. And due to the location of coral reefs in the tropics, often these surround low-lying areas. So these are a very important barrier against wave erosion.
Because actually, you part of your job working with the Living Oceans Foundation there is you went out to Aceh, didn't you, to look at the effect after the tsunami that was happening in the coral reef areas?
Yes, that's correct. We actually went out 10 months after the tsunami hit. And we were on a boat. We went up the west coast of Sumatra and surveyed on the offshore islands. And there we didn't find actually a huge amount of damage. And we were actually quite surprised. Over half the reefs we surveyed, there was no tsunami damage at all. And that's actually the same as studies from Thailand. So we were actually quite surprised that the waves sort of passed over the coral reef itself and did have a very bad impact on land. But actually, the reefs are very resilient to such powerful wave energy.
And so I guess in a way, it's what we found after the tsunami happened was it wasn't so much that the tsunami was having damage on the reefs like you found, but more where we have damaged the reefs ourselves by removing coral for buildings, for damaging fish techniques, because people often use dynamite, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. That's also another point is where they've cleared mangroves for coastal development. I mean, mangroves are very important for coastal protection. So where the reef has been actually mined for the limestone for building material, and also the mangrove has been cleared as they've developed the coastline, that's where the worst tsunami impact was.
Yeah, and I was going to say, we have some crazy fact, don't we, about the number of people who live quite close to coral reefs. It's something like, is it 8% of
the
world?
It's about 8% of the world's population.
Live within 100 kilometres of a coral reef.
A huge, huge number of people living very, very close to a coral reef. And they actually, I mean, most of them, their livelihoods are driven from the coral reef themselves. So the pressure that's being put on coral reefs at the moment is incredibly high.
So we see, sorry, Kat, did you go over?
I was just going to say, I mean, you're talking about coral reefs in the tropics. Do you find corals anywhere else around the world?
There are corals, yes. I mean, you can actually find corals around the UK, for example, but they do not form large reef-like structures. I mean, we're talking about specifically tropical coral reefs, and these are actually the ones that have the symbiotic zooxanthellae, which, so they're called hermatypic corals. And they're the ones that lay down the calcium carbonate skeleton and build this huge, huge structure.
So they're less important around islands like ours, the corals that we have, because they're just there. So are they little blobs?
Well, I could argue with some friends who work in the UK on reef protection in the UK. I wouldn't say they're less important, but certainly, I mean, I don't think that we depend on them so, so strongly as a lot of people who in the tropics don't necessarily have any other alternatives to depend on.
And there's also the deep sea corals, which, like Annalise said, don't have those zooxanthellae in their tissues, and they live very deep down in the dark parts of the ocean. And we've already touched a little bit on the problems that the effects that we're having on the reefs around the world. What particular, if there was, you know, three or four things that are really the main problems for reefs that we're posing to them, what do you think those might be?
Well, the biggest problem we've seen in recent years actually is a natural phenomenon. I mean, it's the El Nino ocean warming that happened in 97-98, and this had a very, very severe impact on the corals. And why this happens is because the water temperature increased and the corals essentially become stressed. And when they become stressed, they spit out their zooxanthellae, these microscopic algae, or the microscopic algae are actually degraded in situ within the coral tissue. And without these zooxanthellae, the corals can't actually live. And this is called coral bleaching.
And it's called that because they turn completely white, don't they?
Well, it's not the corals that actually turn white. It's the zooxanthellae that give them their colour. So if the zooxanthellae are not there, the coral tissue is actually translucent, transparent. And the white that you're seeing is the coral skeleton itself. So an increase in water temperature causes this bleaching phenomenon. And this was very prevalent in 1998, especially in the Western Indian Ocean, where over 90% of some corals were bleached in the Seychelles and the Maldives especially.
And so the corals can't, we say they can't feed if they don't have these zooxanthellae. And do they definitely die or can they actually recover?
They can recover, yes. If the stress is not prolonged, then the corals can actually regain their zooxanthellae and they will regain their colour and they can go on living. It might be that their health is slightly degraded for a short term, but if the stress is prolonged, say if the temperature stays very high for a few months, then the corals don't ever regain their zooxanthellae and they actually die.
Stripping down science.
Okay, let's do it.
The Naked Scientists.
And now we're having a little quick break from all this fishy talk, and we're going to delve into how chemistry is being put to a rather novel use, helping us to track the movements of migrating birds. Now, I know that everyone's been missing Dr. Chris while he's off on his holidays, but here he is to tell us more.
Every year, millions of birds migrate around the planet, looking for a warm place to spend their winter and a cool place with plenty of food to spend the summer. But keeping tabs on where they go and where they've been isn't easy. We really need this information to help conservationists to protect threatened species and also to understand how diseases like avian flu might be spreading around. Until now, though, the process has been very difficult. Attaching trackers to individual birds can be traumatic for the animals and it can also weigh them down, especially if they're small. But now Durham University researcher Laura Font has found a way around the problem, using chemistry. She measures the relative amounts of different isotopes or forms of the metal strontium in a bird's feathers. And because the levels of these strontium isotopes vary in a known way from one geographical area to another, and birds usually shed and then regrow their feathers before they migrate, the strontium in the feathers can be used as a kind of chemical fingerprint, telling researchers where the bird has come from.
We've been developing a technique to measure strontium isotopes in bird feathers. Because there's a biologist in the Department of Biology of Durham University that they came to us with a problem, and basically they wanted to know if we could analyze the strontium isotopes in bird feathers to track migration paths. Because this type of work has been done, this type of analysis has been done in using bones of birds, but obviously you have to capture the bird and kill it and then get substract bone sample.
So what's the sort of scientific basis for using A, strontium, and B, feathers?
Because the strontium ratios are that we analyze in rock samples, they are very characteristic of the different lithologies and also of the age of the rock. So then if a bird is in a particular environment where there's a particular type of rock, then this ratio that is in this environment will be in as well in the tissues of the bird, because this, the ratios of the rock will be, like explained in a very easy way, will be trespassed to the soil and then the plants and all the insects that eat these plants, and then the bird will eat these insects or snails. And then the same ratio will go through this trophic chain.
And why do you use feathers?
Because the migratory birds, they change the feathers when they are in the winter location, and in the summer location, they will change these feathers, you know, in each season. So then each feather will reflect the ratios in the winter location or when they move to the summer location.
So you can get a pretty accurate picture of where the bird has been, where it's come from,
yes,
and then gone to. These amounts of strontium must be absolutely tiny in the feathers.
Yes.
How do you actually measure it?
We use this special technique with micro columns with a special resin. And then we dissolve the feather, we pass it through these small columns, and then we collect the strontium fraction. And then we load these solutions on filaments, and then we analyze it with a thermal ionization mass spectrometer.
And that gives you a picture of what the relative ratios are.
Well, so yes, that gives you a value. Then you also have to analyze soils and look at the geology of the areas where you think that these birds spend their winters and their summers.
This is very useful for people that happen to like looking at where birds have come and gone, but there must be some important medical and scientific principles which would benefit from this. I can think immediately we're all worried about avian flu.
Avian flu, yes, because if we manage to define very well the migration routes of migratory birds, then if we know that there's species that can potentially carry bird flu, then if we manage to characterize these migration paths, then we will manage to find the origin of birds carriers of the flu.
And that was our own Dr. Chris talking to Durham University's Laura Font to find out how strontium, locked up in a bird's feathers, can be used to track where it's been without having to do it any damage.
Sorting out the sparks from the quarks, the Naked Scientists.
You're listening to The Naked Scientists, and now from the colourful world of coral reefs, we shall briefly move across to the link between the land and the sea and the effect that pouring fertilisers has on crops has on biodiversity. On the line now, we have Stan Harpold from the University of California in Irvine. Hi, Stan.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Thanks so much for coming along on The Naked Scientist. Now, Stan, you describe yourself as a community ecologist. What does that actually mean?
Yes, so I study how different species, how different organisms coexist, how they interact, what controls biodiversity, what contributes to loss of biodiversity.
Cool, that sounds great. Now, in your latest paper that came out in the journal Nature, you looked at the link between crop fertilisers and the number of species or the biodiversity that we find in grasslands in California. Now, why did you expect there to be a link between fertilisers and biodiversity?
Well, there's a long-standing theoretical prediction that the diversity of niches, and by niche I mean the different ways that species compete and specialise in nature, that the more complex their niches are, the greater the number of niches, the more species there should be. And that if you do something that reduces the number of niches, there should be fewer species. For plants, then, they're competing for things like nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, water, light, and all these different things. And what we're finding is that natural systems are really quite complex. Plants are competing for many, many different things simultaneously. As we add nitrogen, as we add phosphorus, we lose a niche, basically. And as we add more and more things, make them super abundant, they no longer compete for them, and we see a loss of species.
It seems to me a little bit counterintuitive that if you, I would also possibly expect that you'd get more species if you have more nutrients to kind of go round, if you like. So it seems slightly odd that this is the other way around.
It does. In one way, it's been described as having too much of too many good things.
And I see, right.
And so what happens then, if you add too much nitrogen, too much phosphorus, that you're... What's happening then is the system is becoming limited by just one thing, usually possibly just light, possibly perhaps magnesium or something, but it becomes limited by just one thing, and there just becomes one way for species to differentiate and compete, and so there are just fewer opportunities for them to coexist. And that's what we're seeing in aquatic systems too, is that as we add more and more fertilizers, what happens is it becomes very dark. The algae grow really quickly. Things become so dark that there's only one species that's best adapted to those really low light conditions that can survive.
And so you've got these theories about the interplay between fertilizers and biodiversity. And how did you actually go about testing those theories and what's actually happening in the real world?
Yeah, so I work in grassland communities. These are natural prairie-type systems. They have many, many native species, many exotic species, but there's fairly high grassland diversity. And then we added combinations of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and water. And what we found is if we added just one thing, that there wasn't much impact on diversity. And as we added more and more things, and up to all four things at once, we saw the biggest loss of diversity. So this is evidence for this sort of loss of niche dimension. So as we take away each one of these specialties that plants have, there are fewer opportunities for them to coexist, and we end up with like in aquatic systems, the species that's the best competitor for really high nutrients but really low light conditions, and so just one species.
And how long did it take for these changes to take place? How long did you have to keep watching?
This was within 2 years. It was very quick. We've also looked at really long-term data sets, and this loss of diversity can persist for 150 years. There's a great experiment in the UK, the Park Grass Experiment. They've been applying fertilizer since 1856, 1858.
Some long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
That sounds great.
And there's no recovery of species diversity even after all that time. So it can be a very long-term effect.
That's amazing. But surely a reduction in the biodiversity in terms of field crops, because we're talking about fertilizers here, I take it these nutrients that you were looking at, nitrogen, phosphorus, are the kind of things that we put on crops, are they? That's the sort of thing we
yes.
do to fertilize the crops.
But the problem is that they don't stay on just the agricultural land. The nitrogen can volatilize and go up into the atmosphere and come back down as rain or precipitation. Phosphorus can wash off into streams and then wash into rivers and then into the gulfs and coasts and so on. And so they're very large dead zones, what they're called, these huge areas where there's been a lot of fertilizer input, tens of thousands of square kilometers. All this fertilizer causes really high algae growth, causes really strong decrease in light. And then one way that marine systems differ from, like, the grassland systems I work on is that as all these algae fall to the bottom of the ocean and die, they decompose. And in the process, oxygen is depleted. And the oxygen then kills the fish. And this creates this dead zone.
And I take it that I'm actually pretty ignorant about just how much fertilizer we use globally every year. Is it really huge amounts that we're still using? I mean, we talk about organic farming. I imagine that's still really tiny proportion. But
yes.
Fertilizers really are pretty used everywhere in huge amounts, are they?
And nitrogen in particular. Humans have become... probably as big of an input of nitrogen into natural systems as natural processes are. We are one of the drivers of the nitrogen cycle now globally.
And you think that also possibly there's a link to our burning fossil fuels and this sort of input of nutrients into systems, is that right?
Absolutely. A lot of nitrogen then comes from fossil fuel combustion. These nitric acids then eventually come back down somewhere, and they're usually in places where nitrogen is not so abundant. And so we're increasing the abundance of nitrogen in systems that were typically pretty limited in nitrogen.
And you mentioned already that we had this long-term study based here in the UK and that we haven't seen much recovery in that time. So if we aren't seeing any recovery in systems, is there anything that we can do? You're finding out this, you know, studying more about the effects that fertilizers are having. But what can we actually do about this in terms of the impact it's having on biodiversity?
Yeah, I think the main thing is to reduce the inputs of nutrient pollution to natural systems, and that can be changing our fertilization techniques in managed agricultural systems. It can reduce fossil fuel combustion. But then we can also try to manage natural systems so that we can, find ways that we can remove excess nutrients if possible. There's been some study trying to restore natural systems by decreasing the amount of nitrogen available, and that's still work that's in early stages, but there's effort along those lines.
So still things that we can do. I wanted to bring Annalise back in at this point because you already mentioned, Stan, we're talking about the impact in the water systems, and we're looking at species that tend to grow much more quickly under high nutrient conditions and cause this sort of dead zones as well. But we know on coral reefs as well that if we add nutrients that we can cause an imbalance, can't we, with algae growth. Is that right, Annalise?
Yes, I mean, definitely. Nutrient impact will greatly increase macroalgae on coral reefs.
That's big, fleshy, kind of...
Like seaweed.
Rubbery. Seaweed, yeah, okay.
yes, and because coral reefs, with their symbiotic relationship with their zooxanthellae, they have to have light in order to live, which means that they're very restricted by depth. So generally, coral reefs only thrive in the upper 30 metres of the oceans. So within this zone, there are lots and lots and lots of animals that want to live within this zone, and so competition for space is a huge problem. And so with nutrient enrichment, if there's more macroalgae, then that could outcompete the corals, and especially that will take over any bare surfaces, so coral larvae can't then settle and the coral reefs can't develop anymore.
And we're seeing that quite a lot, aren't we? We're seeing reefs that are becoming sort of dominated by algae, and then it's very difficult to shift back to a system where they're actually dominated by corals again,
difficult.
Like you described.
Yeah, and one big problem as well is human impact of overfishing, because if the fishermen are removing the herbivorous fish, which actually will control the macroalgal population, if those fish are removed from the ecosystem, then that allows more macroalgae to grow, so that will further outcompete the corals.
So it's all a big complex system indeed. Well, thanks so much, Stan, for coming on the show for us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Excellent. And we'll talk to Annalise probably a little bit. We'll keep her here in the studio.
Fancy listening to the Naked Scientists in your bed, on your way to work, or even at work? Mm-hmm. Why not subscribe to our podcast? For more information, visit nakedscientists.com/podcast.
That's right, you're listening to a fishy episode of The Naked Scientist with me, Helen and Kat. And we have Annalise Hagen in the studio talking all about coral reefs and wonderful things that we can see, but also the effects that we're having on those ecosystems and the problems we're causing. Now, I've had a couple of emails here along the fishy line, some questions, which I thought I'd possibly throw out at this point and see if anyone in the studio has some ideas on. They're both along the same lines. First, we have Jennifer from Cambridge, who says, is it better ecologically regarding health to eat farmed or wild salmon? I don't know if Annalise has any thoughts on this. I can certainly talk about this too. She's looking a bit stumped.
Helen, you know I'm a coral specialist.
She is
You're
a coral
the fish specialist.
Okay, all right. Well, in terms of whether or not farmed fish in general is better than wild fish, obviously we know and we can imagine the problems of harvesting, taking too many fish from the sea and not leaving enough behind for them to keep their populations going. But there are also problems also associated with eating fish that's been farmed. And partly we know problems like fish can escape from farms and cause genetic pollution, if you like, by breeding with wild species. We also see farmed fish farms actually, they can infect a wild migrating salmon with parasites. There's actually a study from the university in Canada. Actually, I'm looking for which one it is. I can't remember. Anyway, it showed that young salmon, as they migrate back up rivers and as they go past fish farms, they actually pick up sea lice, which can actually cause huge levels of mortality amongst those salmon. So really, and the other problem with farmed salmon is that you feed other fish to the fish. So you're not actually cutting out the need to take any fish from the environment, because these are piscivorous. They eat other fish. Yes, it's true. Fish eat fish, I'm afraid. So you're actually having to harvest. You're still having to catch fish from the wild to feed the fish in the farms. So it's a difficult thing. I think maybe the organic farming is one way that at least it's a bit better, because you're using less chemicals, which is another problem from farms, which adds to the pollution, lower stocking density. So they're generally a bit less of an impact, but you still might have problems with things like sea lice. But then you also have the problem of catching wild fish. I think if you do want to know more about which fish are best to eat, you can go to the Marine Stewardship Council website, because they are actually the biggest global organisation for issuing eco-labelling, if you like, to say which fish stocks are sustainable. And one of them is actually the Alaskan salmon population, which which are certified as being sustainable. So you can eat them with what you buy them, I think, from many supermarkets in the UK, certainly. And they are doing less damage to the environment. So that's a good thing.
Well, we've got a question. It's from Charles Buckden. And he says, hello, I heard that there's a huge mass of plastic waste in the Northwest Pacific. Do we know anything about this? I mean, what's the story with plastic pollution in the sea?
Well, I'm sure Annalise will back me up here as well, even though she is a coral person. But no, that the
I can talk about plastic.
Plastic waste
in the
sea is a very, very huge problem. Plastic waste generally, but in the sea particularly, isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I've been very lucky in that I've worked on a lot of uninhabited islands. And it's really, really evident when you go to these uninhabited islands, the amount of plastic waste that must be floating around the world's oceans, because all the beaches are just covered in bits of plastic and always flip-flops. My friend
flip-flops.
And I actually have a bit of a joke about this thing when we were working in the Seychelles together, and we went to lots of uninhabited islands, and on every different island there were flip-flops, loads of flip-flops.
Pairs or just odd ones?
Odd ones. Now, there's actually a friend of a friend in the Seychelles who has started doing some flip-flop art, and she takes all different shades of one colour and does a collage with flip-flops and sells them.
Fantastic. Well, anyway, but on a serious, more serious note, yes, plastic waste is a huge problem. I don't know in terms of this particular one in the Pacific Northwest that this.
There are going
to
be some areas
to.
Where ocean circulation will obviously bring together plastic in certain areas. I mean, I think that's all we can say. We don't know about the specific example.
That's right. I mean, I think on a kind of positive note, that when there's things like containers that burst at sea, and I think there's things like rubber ducks, aren't there? That
I've definitely heard about rubber ducks floating around the world's oceans.
And then you can actually track where the currents are going, because they're taking the rubber ducks along with the ocean currents, and that's one way of studying it, strangely. So that, you know, in some ways we can get something good out of it, but there is a real problem with too much plastic waste ending up in the oceans. But Annalise, you started telling us a little just now about your wonderful times overseas, and we did promise a short description of your studying the coral reefs from the air. Now, what is that all about? How can you study something underwater while looking at it from a long way above?
Yeah, well, this is a very clever technique, really, that's been developed. And on my last two expeditions, we were employing a sensor called a compact airborne spectrographic imager.
I think it's a posh digital camera, isn't it?
CASSIE for short. And essentially, it's a passive sensor that is fixed onto a seaplane and flown over an area of interest, and it records the amount of light reflected from different things on the seabed. So it can tell you what's coral, what's algae, what's seagrass. But it doesn't actually tell you what it is. You need some divers in the water at the time.
So you still have to be there in the water.
You still have to be there, exactly. Yeah, so you go out and do your dives with your GPS, and then you basically collect data to calibrate the data that's collected from the aeroplane.
And I guess that way you get a lot more information than you would if you were just diving on its own.
You can get a huge amount of data. I mean, we collected recently on a 3-week expedition, we collected 2,700 square kilometres of data.
That's
which
an awful lot.
Is unheard of if you were just diving.
That's fantastic. Well, I can imagine this must be a very exciting job for you. And I hope if anyone wants to find out more about the Living Oceans Foundation, then go to their website, which we have linked from our website, I think. But is it livingoceansfoundation.org?
Yes, it's livingoceansfoundation.org.
Yes. So you can find out more about all the wonderful things that Annalise does.
Well, that's about all we've got time for this week. On next week's show, we're going to be investigating the secrets in our genes with population geneticists Turi King and Bruce Winnie. We'll be asking, where did we come from? How do our genes make us who we are? Who were our ancestors? And how do we use genetics to track them down? And we'll also be joined by Mike Majeris from Cambridge University to find out what insect genes can tell us about our environment. All will be revealed on The Naked Scientist next week. So if you've got any questions about genes and genetics for our experts, then email us at chris@thenakedscientist.com. And if you want to take part in next week's kitchen science, then all you need is 3 jam jars, one full of jam, one full of water, and one full of air.
I think that just remains for me to say a huge thank you to our guests this week, Annalise Hagen and Stan Harpole, and to our co-presenter Kat and Petro, who's been doing a fantastic job on the desk there. And just to remind you that you can also listen to the Nature podcast, which will give you a rundown of the latest studies in that journal. And that's www.nature.com/nature/podcast. And of course, we've also got our new whizzy, bangy website ourselves. That's the Naked Scientist website. You can go on our forum. You can download podcasts. If you're listening on a podcast, you've already done that. But anyway, go and have a look. It's all fantastic. And remember to have a listen to us again next week. Thanks very much for listening.
Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.